Welcome to the Industrialist Podcast, the ultimate destination for profound insights into the world of industrial entrepreneurship. At the Industrialist Podcast, our mission is to unravel the tales of triumph and resilience from successful owners, CEOs, and leaders who've not only founded but scaled industrial companies in the US and across the globe. Each episode will bring you unfiltered conversations with manufacturing visionaries, exploring their journeys from accountability and learning curves to tough decisions and crisis management. What sets us apart? These are the real stories told by those who bear the full responsibility of family businesses impacting countless lives. Join us on the Industrial Podcast, where raw conversations about real-life success stories provide the insights leaders need to tackle their own business challenges and turn them into opportunities. Get ready to dive into the world of manufacturing excellence. This is the Industrialist Podcast, where industry leaders, real stories, and actionable strategies converge. Greetings, industrial enthusiasts, and welcome to a captivating episode of the Industrialist Podcast. I'm Anne Kappel, co-founder in Altix Consulting, your host on today's journey into the heart of manufacturing excellence. Joining me is Yannick Schilly, co-founder and president and CEO of Altix Consulting, who will lead us through a fascinating conversation. And today we're privileged to host Bo Easton, the second generation owner and COO of Meyer Tool, and a dynamic force behind a high-tech manufacturing company that has significantly impacted the aerospace and gas turbine industry for over 70 years. Bo's journey is a testament to Meyer Tool's evolution from a motorcycle chop shop garage to a globally recognized player with 13 locations and over 1,500 team members. Armed with a Bachelor of Applied Science in Industrial and Organizational Psychology, Bo has played a pivotal role in Meyer Tool's success, showcasing expertise in lean manufacturing, continuous improvement, Six Sigma, digitalization, and more. In this episode, we'll delve into the remarkable history of Meyer Tool, exploring its strategies for continuous growth, and the people-centric philosophy that defines its success, setting it apart in the industry. So without further ado, let's join Yannick Schilly and get ready for an insightful and inspiring conversation with our distinguished guest, Bo Easton. This is the Industrialist Podcast, where real leaders, real stories, and actionable strategies unfold.
Well, welcome from my side, Bo. It's great to see you. And I cannot tell you how excited I am to have this conversation with you today. We had a few conversations in the past, and it's always been a pleasure to talk about industry, about manufacturing, to talk about digitalization, automation, and I had the pleasure to see some of your factories, and I was always very impressed. So thank you so much for being with us today, Bo. It's a real treat. And as you know, we are very passionate about industry and about everything going on in the industry. So I think our audience will really enjoy that conversation with you. And you have an exceptional company you have been building over the years, and we can't wait to hear that story. So maybe we start, Bo, with if you could please introduce yourself a little bit to our audience, and please give us a brief introduction about Meyer Tool, like what is the core mission of the company and what kind of problem do you solve for your customers, and give us some examples of who are some of your customers and what kind of industries do you serve?
Sure. Well, first of all, I'd like to thank yourself, Yannick, and Ann for inviting me here. We've always had great conversations. I enjoyed giving you the tours. I love what you guys are doing, and I'm excited for this opportunity to kind of share what we're doing in the industry. Brief synopsis of Meyer Tool. We are a specialized manufacturer in advanced manufacturing for the OEMs in the aerospace and defense systems. We supply the hot section components for the gas turbine engines for both power generation and aerospace. So we work from the combustor back through the afterburner in the engines. And our niche is high-pressure nozzles, blades, combustors, hangers, shrouds, pretty much anything behind the flame in the engine. We work with super alloys. Our niche is the, and what we're best known for is the film cooling scheme to keep the parts cool in the engine so that they don't melt. Because the temperature, operating temperature of the engine is so much higher than what the metal itself can take. So even though we're working with super alloys, they have to be properly cooled and coated in order to sustain their life in the engine. So what we're really known for is small hole drilling and form, fit, and function of the high-pressure nozzles and low-pressure nozzles. Our niche is electrical discharge machining, or ARC, or spark machining, as it's also known. And that's basically a controlled drilling process or shaping process that works at between 17,000 and 21,000 degrees Fahrenheit. So it's actually hotter than the sun, and then we control that in microbursts. We also work with laser in terms of laser welding, laser drilling, laser cutting, water jet, multi-axis water jet, 5 to 8 axes, and 3D contour with drilling with water jet. We also do cutting and chemical stripping with it, or I'm sorry, physical stripping with the water jet. We do chemical stripping and coating. We try to be a one-stop shop for the OEMs. You mentioned who are some of our customers. We deal with the Pratt & Whitney's and Raytheon's, the General Electric's, Honeywell, Rolls-Royce. Those are our big players. And then we also supply some of the first-tier suppliers who in turn supply the OEMs. And then they supply Airbus, Boeing, Lockheed Martin, Bombardier.
This is fascinating, Bo. The technology is incredible when you think about those hot pieces in the hot section of an airplane. This is at the borderlines of physics for those materials. So you must have accumulated over decades a wealth of knowledge to be able to interact with the engineers of your customers to really understand how to design and manufacture those parts for maximum durability and functionality.
Yes, we do concurrent engineering with them. We're pretty vertically integrated. We build our own equipment, and we're on our fifth generation of our electrical discharge machining for doing the small hole drilling. And it was built around the technology that was needed to accomplish what the customer wanted. And in turn, with the concurrent engineering, they've been able to change their designs going forward. And each new generation of technology that they come out with pushes the limits, but it's based on what we're now capable of from feedback from them, feedback that we've seen from our parts, the results that we're getting. And we continue to perform the research and development work that we need to come up with the next better process.
Bo, do you have any applications which go beyond or outside the aerospace and aviation industry? Do you do something with space or marine?
We don't do space. We do electric boat. So we do submarines. Mm-hmm. That's recent acquisitions. We're into the electric boats and the missiles now as well. Mm-hmm. And tanks.
Okay.
And then large power generation turbines for the industrial gas turbine industry.
Well, thank you, Bo, for this. Can you tell us a little bit how everything got started with the company from the very early days, and tell us a little bit that entrepreneurial journey, which is amazing? Yeah, what has it been also for you as a kid to grow in an environment where your father was an entrepreneur? And tell us about those early life moments and how you evolved in that environment.
Sure. Well, I would say Meyer Tools started with very humble beginnings. It was a small garage on Spring Grove Avenue in Camp Washington with Bud Meyer. It actually began as a motorcycle chop shop, as Ahmed mentioned, and they were customizing motorcycles, and Bud got into tool and die manufacturing, some simple tool and die. And my father at the time was working with General Electric. He was a plant manager. He had been a electrical engineer with Cincinnati Millicron designing EDM machines prior. And then he met Bud, and Bud was doing some work for him. He got laid off from General Electric, worked with another local manufacturer. Unfortunately, that didn't work out, or fortunately, I should say now. And his connection with Bud held strong, and he purchased one EDM machine, and Bud gave him some space in his garage to begin what became Meyer Tool with the whole EDM production process. And that was in 1973. Bud started in 51, and my father joined with him in 1973. And I know that because my mother was pregnant with me at the time, and I was born when he started the company with Bud. So I'm showing my age there. Let's just say it started in the 80s, but he's been involved for 50 years now. That's when the whole merger started. And so we started with one electrical discharge machine, and then we got involved with Kenner and Corning. Interesting story about Kenner, and you mentioned my early childhood with him. They were making the tools and dies for the Star Wars toys. I actually have the original Millennium Falcon. That was a test.
How cool is that?
No, it was very cool. I've got that locked up in a closet, and I got to test a lot of the figures and the Death Star and all these things that they were molding. Mm-hmm. But then, so we're working with Kenner, doing the Star Wars, doing the other toys, and I got to test all that, which was wonderful. But then they got involved with tank nozzles, and that was when we really got involved with turbine engines. The M1 Abrams tank, it's powered by a turbine, and we do a high-pressure nozzle for it. We still do it today. So we've been doing that for 50 years.
Wow.
And it's made some changes, obviously, over the years, but that got us into production mode. And then once we started that, people found out, hey, they can tool and produce form, fit, and function on these nozzles and these hot section components with these super alloys, the nickel, cobalt, and chromium. And they have the quality control system to inspect it and certify it and get it out there. So that got us into aerospace. So Meyer started getting into the business and aviation side, the smaller turbine engines initially and the turboprops, and doing some military work, continuing on with the tanks and things like that. Then in the early 90s, we got involved in the CFM56 program. Very high volume. It was one of the largest selling engines of all time, narrow bodies for the 737s and the A320s, A330s. Huge, huge volumes on that. So we got into lean manufacturing, started setting up cells, and we're producing up to 2,500 blades a week. And once we got into the high pressure blade work and we were doing the nozzles to support that behind it in the engine, word got out that Meyer was ready to do aerospace production at high volumes. And from there, we took off. Now we're not just doing the low volume business aviation stuff. We're doing the high volume commercial. And then the next evolution for us was the military work. We were sole sourced on the F-18 Super Hornet, the replacement 414 engine, and then the F-22. We were doing the F-16s and now the F-35s. And most of those we are sole sourced on for the hot section components that we do. Pretty advanced technology. It definitely pushes the limits, and it has our R&D work groups working round the clock pretty much. You've heard of Skunk Works with Lockheed Martin? Well, we have Black Sheep Works. They have their own quality system. We're able to test new technology, try applications out. We just can't certify the hardware that comes off it because it's not ISO and AS9100. But it allows us to rapidly prototype and get a process going. And we've been doing that over and over again with all these new government contracts that are pushing the limits of the technology and the metals.
Well, that's amazing. We'll come back to technology and innovation and R&D a little bit later in the conversation. I want to stay for a moment a little bit on that evolution path and early stage and a little bit through your personal growth evolving in an entrepreneurial environment. Are there any kind of childhood memories what come back when you're a teenager or a young adult where you have learned things from your father, which till today stick with you?
Sure. I remember pretty much all my life, I would go in and tour the shop and see whatever new machines he had, whatever new robots, new technology, new CAD. When they switched to CAD, I got to go test out the CAD software and play with it and everything, which I always thought was exciting. When I was 14, I was mowing the lawns for the facilities we have locally. When I was 15, I was cleaning the machines and tightening the bolts, working with the maintenance groups. And then once I turned 16 in the summers, I was running machines. I was doing the EDM work and the grinding or abrasive machining. And then off and on throughout high school and college, in the summer times, I would work in the shops or inspection. And yeah, it was a really good experience. Got to try all different types of equipment and get to know all the people that I've grown up with. Some are retiring now, some of the ones who trained me. But a very good experience. Yeah, we grew up in a farming community. We were kind of isolated, so it was nice to be able to go into the city and see the equipment, see the technology, and be around all the good people that we have in the company.
Yeah, I think that that early involvement really helps to develop that culture of industry and that, that culture of an industrialist. Yeah, having worked with maintenance, having been in every function of the organization, A, develops bonds to the people, and B, you really know what you're talking about because you have been in so many shoes and you have practiced so many different roles in the organization. Yeah.
Right after college, my father said, no, you need to go out and, the, you know, try something else. So I went to Fidelity Investments for a couple years and got my Series 7. It was great training. It was a wonderful experience, and Fidelity is a fantastic company. I happened to be there during the time that the dot-coms had just come out and then were starting to burst. And the housing, everybody was flipping houses at the time. And then all of a sudden that market fell out. And one day I was sitting there saying, "What? I don't know why I'm sitting here getting yelled at for something I have no control over every day." Because I'm dealing with people's money and their savings. And they chose to invest in certain areas that failed, unfortunately. I said, boy, manufacturing was a lot more interesting and a lot more fun. So that's when I got back involved with Meijer. And became involved in the quality engineering portion of the company.
So when was that? That would have been about
96, 97.
Okay. Yeah.
And that's when I went full time.
Okay. So let's talk a little bit about leadership. Being an entrepreneur, being a business owner, being a leader in any kind of organization is really something what needs to be learned and something what needs to be mastered. And it's really difficult to gain mastery in leadership. Maybe we will never really gain mastership, but it's also a continuous improvement journey, like so many things. How would you talk about your own discovery of the leadership journey and how to become a good leader? Talk a little bit about that.
Okay. Well, I would say we had excellent mentors within the company. My father, excellent entrepreneur, businessman, engineer. Our vice president, Jerry Flair, was a mentor of mine. He was an ex-GE manager. He had gone through all their training programs. And my previous boss, Gordy McGuire, was the director of quality since Meijer had started, and he was a great influence. So we had wonderful leaders that guided us and helped us along the way. My background was in industrial organizational psychology, which is about leadership and cultural development for organizations. So I had some exposure to different philosophies on leadership. I personally believe a lot of good comes from leadership through service, servitude to your employees and trying to be supportive and, you know, let the experts make the decisions and then back it up, help them back it up. I've done 10 years with the Vistage Group locally. If you're not familiar with Vistage, it's a peer group and kind of an MBA program that's taught to CEOs and COOs by successful CEOs rather than universities. So it's people that have had real-world experience and success, and I've gotten a lot out of that program. We've also done a 3-tiered leadership development program within the organization, where we had the top management, the middle management, and then the up-and-coming leaders and the cell leaders from the shop. And that was very successful. And we're actually in negotiations and talks right now to start up a second round of that program because we had such good response from everyone. And we've seen the rewards and the benefits from having a structured training program and a succession plan.
Excellent. Are there any experiences being a leader which have marked you, some things which trigger and still trigger memories today where you realized this was a growth moment in my own leadership journey? Anything comes to mind?
I would say our continual improvement program, leading that. We had four waves initially of Six Sigma programs, and one of our teams went to nationals for the Association for Quality and Participation and got to compete in Orlando. Out of 250 teams, we were in the top 20 and got to go. And, you know, that was a good experience for me leading that program, and then also to see everybody get involved and see the benefits of continual improvement and participation. Some things I would say that we're trying for leadership. We had a ransomware attack. Someone opened an email, and sure enough, we got shut down. North Korea took us down for 9 days. And it was a harrowing experience because customers need their hardware, but the ERP system and everything else, all the machines were on lockdown. We had to rally the troops. It was 24/7 and get everything rebooted to the, we do daily backups on everything. And we had all the machinists, the engineers, quality, anyone who could use a computer was working with computers to do the backups and installs. So that was a moment that sticks out. And then getting through the COVID without any layoffs. That was a, you know, from a leadership perspective, we had to make some hard calls. You know, our customers put it in the purchase order that we had to assure them we would lay off 10 to 15% of our workforce if we needed to in order to make deliveries and keep the doors open and lights on. And my response was, no, we're not doing that. So we haven't laid off and we have no plans. That's one of the nice things about being privately held is we don't have investors and quarter points we have to make. We got to keep the banks happy. As long as we keep the banks happy, lights stay on and everybody's employed and has health care and food on their table.
Well, these are really remarkable moments. Certainly a cyber attack, what takes your business down, that's pretty scary. COVID was a pretty scary period. So how did you learn to keep your head cool in those moments of what's going on?
Yeah. What was it Rudyard Kipling wrote? If you can keep your head about you while all those around you are losing theirs and blaming you, and if you can trust in yourself when everyone else is doubting and still make allowance for their doubts, then you're a man.
Yeah.
And I've always thought that was a good quote. It's one of my mantras, and to remember to, okay, got to trust in your gut and, you know, your experience, and people are going to be nervous. And I can tell you during COVID and the ransomware attack, there were a lot of nervous people.
Mm-hmm.
But you just got to, you got to push through it and you got to inspire.
That piece you mentioned from Rudyard Kipling, is one of my favorite pieces of poetry as well. And I find so much in that little piece what really can inspire people and a man, how to become a man. Thank you. Thank you for sharing that. So let's talk a little bit about, you mentioned that you early on when you studied, you learned about organizational psychology, and this is really important. Organizational psychology, very often a little bit misunderstood or ignored even, but so important for so many things. The people side of the business, the human resources side, change management. So tell us a little bit about your culture at MyAtool. What kind of culture are you trying or have you built, and over the decades, and what kind of culture are you trying to maintain?
I would say the biggest thing is that change is okay. We've been pushing continual improvement since the mid-90s, I would say. It started with the push for, I forget what they called it. It was zero defects and all. Mm-hmm. And then when we got involved with Six Sigma and started training black belts and green belts, I'm a master black belt, mm-hmm. and I've certified quite a few people. Mm-hmm. We started doing these projects and pulling people, you know, taking time off the shop floor, out of the offices, getting cross-functional groups together and brainstorming. You know, we'd go through the problems. You go through the DMAIC process. Mm-hmm. They see that, okay, we've got good data now. Let's brainstorm what the potential variables, the inputs and outputs are. Let's measure them. Let's come back together. Let's all talk about it. And then have the experts, the people that are doing it day in, day out, tell us what would make it easier, what would make it more stable, what would make it more repeatable, what would save time, things like that. And then we have the data to back it up. We are very data intensive. I think you've seen some examples of that.
Very impressive. Very impressive.
So we try to make our decisions based on numbers. We have real-time and historical data for everything. And we're able to present that to the cross-functional teams and say, okay, here's the reality. Now, what do we need to do to fix it? What can we give you?
There is a thing, Bo, in my dialogues with either entrepreneurs or business leaders, which at times I sense is a little bit misunderstood. And I sense from what I have observed that you get that right. And I want to touch on that a little bit. Having a good culture is not in conflict with a high-performance organization. You can have a good culture and still a high-performance organization aiming for excellence in quality, aiming for a good productivity and the continuous aim to minimize waste and improve your efficiencies. Those things are not conflicting. Talk a little bit about that. What's your view on that? How do we maintain people happy and having a people-centric culture while still having accountability and holding people accountable for... Because at the end of the day, it's a business. We need to run a business. We need to deliver good products to our customers. How do you keep that balance?
Buy-in. The why we're doing things. The communication. I think that's huge, you know. We do town hall meetings. We do all hands meetings. We do the, like I mentioned, the continual improvement group meetings. We have daily and weekly in the shop SQPD meetings. Monthly, we have our business unit meetings with the, or reviews with the engineering and the business leaders. And the idea is communication. If everybody understands the why when you're trying to make the change, the buy-in is so much better. You know, if you just try and push it, if you just roll it out and say, here's the flavor of the month, you know, no one's going to put their heart into it. But when you're doing, like we did in our largest plant, the headquarters in Camp Washington, a couple of years ago, we did a huge 6S program upgrade. And, you know, we spent a lot of time going over the why. Why, you know, or get the toolboxes are going out. Here's why, all the reasons. We need space. We need organization. We need continuity, consistency, and we don't need things disappearing. And, you know, we were able to achieve that by it. People necessarily weren't thrilled that you're taking their toolbox and their family photos and everything away, but they understood the why. And then once they got, you know, the new toolkits with everything laid out appropriately in 6S format, they understood. Had we just come and said, okay, tomorrow you take your toolboxes out, you know, it's not going to work. Also, we get a lot of feedback from our machinists and engineers through what we call our workstation audit forms. Every job, every time it's set up, has a checklist and then an opportunity for continual improvement or suggestions. And that all gets fed into a system that gets followed up on. And if it doesn't get followed up on by the appropriate individuals, it gets escalated to the engineering and quality managers. So people understand that their feedback is being taken seriously. We have to make contact within the first 48 hours of receiving feedback, or the system starts escalating. And then we also have with the shop, we have the SQPD meetings where they have the opportunity to talk about the safety, quality, production, and our delivery schedules. And so everyone knows they have a voice. Now, sometimes things are suggested that don't necessarily make operational sense, and we make sure that that gets communicated. So we're getting a lot better on the communication side. And I think that has really helped with the culture. And I think people seeing that we take their suggestions seriously and incorporate them helps achieve buy-in as well and creates that culture. Along with our employee-centric culture, we have the profit sharing, the Christmas bonus, as long as the company's making money. We have a very interesting dynamic. It's a very family environment. We do have a lot of families that work there, which is a pro and a con. Sometimes families have drama, but at the same time, families are very loyal to each other and to the company. So it's been a win for us. And when anyone in the company gets sick, hurt, injured, or has a loss of a family member, everybody comes together. They do basket raffles. They do bake sales, walks, things like that to help support each other. And that's across amazing. The board at all levels. It's not one group. And that's not just one site. I've noticed that's throughout the Meyer facilities. Then we have the Christmas party as well. We have our own Meyer band.
Oh, yeah. And you're on that band as well.
Right? I am. I'm the lead guitarist. So we get together twice a year. We play at Christmas, and then we play at the family open house. We offer open houses at all of our sites so the families can come in and see what everybody does.
So, you're one of the locations, and your headquarter is right in, I would say, nearly in the center of downtown Cincinnati, or very close. Has it been a benefit to be so close to the city center, or has it been more a pain point? How would you look at that?
I would say it's been a benefit. We're right off the exit. So, and we're just across the river from Kentucky. We have two sites in Kentucky. We have two sites in Ohio. And so we're right there off the river. We're right there off the expressway. We're 20 minutes from the airport. It's easy to ship. It's easy to transport back and forth between three of our busiest sites. Mm-hmm. I'd say it's been a benefit. And we're on a bus route. And we have a lot of people who live in that Camp Washington and Brighton area that basically can walk to work if they need to.
Yeah, excellent. Mm-hmm. And we spoke about culture, and I think I remember from past conversations that you have a very stable workforce. So very limited attrition or turnaround, which nowadays is very important, for especially when you're in that kind of high-tech business you are, where knowledge management matters so much, where people know what they are doing. So that's a real strength your company has.
Yes. We're very proud of what we call our wall of fame, which is displayed proudly in our main lobby headquarters. And it's got hundreds of names broken down by five-year periods with their tenure at Meyer Tool. And we have lots of people ranging from 5 to 10 to 20, up to 40 plus years on that board. And we're very proud of that. It's really a win-win. The loyalty between management and the family to the employees, and then the employees back to us, because one, consistency for everyone and their families. And then two, for us, from a knowledge, like you mentioned, we build our own equipment. You can't learn this at another facility. So if we spend 6 months or a year, you know, training or cross-training, we would hate to lose that talent. And at the same time, we try to offer our employees the best health care in the industry. We're very, very competitive in terms of health care for their families. I believe the going rate, and I could be a couple dollars off, but I believe it's between $20 and $30 a week for full coverage, $5 prescriptions, pretty much unlimited in terms of what we cover. And our main thing is we want to take care of everyone and their families. Yeah, and I think they understand that. And in return, they take care of us and the company. So there's a lot of loyalty back and forth. And it does show on that wall of fame. And I make sure that all of our customers see that when they come in to understand that, you know, we have the all that experience and knowledge at our disposal there to support them.
Apropos fame, I remember also from one of my visits that you had even presidents visiting your facility. Tell us a little bit about that.
Sure. President George Bush in 2006 was coming into the area to talk about tax cuts and things to support small businesses and medium-sized businesses. And we were selected to host him. So I actually got to spend an hour walking the president around the company and showing him our different processes. And he was in the National Guard. He was a pilot. And he knew exactly, as I'd show him the parts, where it went in the engine, what it did. And he understood what we were doing to create it. Very personable gentleman to talk to. Whether you like his politics or not, he was extremely friendly and just an easygoing guy and knowledgeable. And it was funny. For the week leading up to there, all the security that went into it was just unbelievable. We had plainclothes Secret Service working at Meyer Tool, and no one knew it except for three of us. Everybody got wanded. They had dogs sniffing, snipers on the roof. It was crazy. And they made sure that everybody stayed away from the president except for the people that he was talking to at the machines. Well, as soon as the president got done with his speech, he just ran right over to all the people that were taped off and started taking pictures, shaking hands and hugging, and just got in the middle of the crowd, and the Secret Service just threw their hands up. But they sent us the pictures that they took because we couldn't have cameras in there. And so everybody has their picture with the president. And one funny thing about it, I told the person in charge of presidential advances, I said, you know, at the time I was a quality director. I said, I'm a, you know, being a quality guy, I just feel you should understand this. I saw you wanded everybody, put them through metal detectors, had the dog sniff them before he came in. I said, no one ever checked me at all for anything. And he said, oh, Mr. Easton, you haven't left our site in 5 days. So I had to think about what I did that weekend and, where'd I go? Who'd I talk to?
That's funny. So let's talk a little bit about innovation and advanced technologies. Like, I mean, the world is changing permanently. The technologies and the parts and the materials you are working on are, as we established a little bit earlier, already borderline of what physics can do. So how do you keep at the forefront with your team, with your R&D, with your quality, and with every other function in the organization? How do you make sure you stay at the forefront to remain the best-in-class company in that sector?
We budget for R&D. And we have a really technical R&D team, these guys. We have a lot of experience. We pulled in a lot of people from the outside. We pulled in people from our teams that have been with us 20-plus years. Our engineering leads are... We have an advanced technology division with all kinds of electrical engineering experience and programming experience. And they all make up the Black Sheep Works that's continuing to do the R&D on our... Mostly on the EDM, the water jet, and the coating right now is the focus because there's not enough coating capacity, plating capacity in the industry. So we're working on that and becoming more efficient with it. In terms of the EDM, faster and cleaner drilling, you know, minimizing the recast and the impact to the material. And we've come up with a lot of new techniques and processes over the last 2 years that are now in this fifth generation. And then we're also working with robotics and AI now. So we're moving into that. We're moving from the industry 4.0, where we were collecting the data, displaying the data, and making decisions off of it in real time, to collaboration with the robots and the robots being able to make decisions for where this part should go next, which machines are going to be available, things like that. The fifth generation technology was all designed so that someone could run the cell basically from outside the cell, and they'd be managing the robotics and the automation of the machines. So there won't be layoffs from it. We're not going to downsize to incorporate this new technology, but my goal is to be able to scale up for the new volumes that we're seeing. I mean, we're having a record year this year. Next year is going to be even higher volumes. So my goal is to not have to grow the workforce linearly and be able to incorporate the technology and automation and be able to do what we need to do with our existing workforce, because it's tough to hire and find talent. And now, one of the things you'd mentioned earlier, and I probably should have said this then, you know, key things as a leader and that stick out and that have helped shape is trying to manage the boomer generation down to the millennials at the same time, because they want and mm-hmm. need two different strategies. Mm-hmm. So that's something that we face every day. You know, we're bringing in new millennials in training, and they're great, very talented, very technical. But then you have the boomers who like, you know, I want all the overtime I can get, mm-hmm. you know, work ethic. They take pride and self-esteem based on their what they've accomplished that day. And then we have the millennials who, you know, they want their home work-life balance, and they want a pat on the back. So we're working on improving our recognition programs and things like that, to show employee appreciation and do more things to get the millennials excited and looking at alternative schedules as well. But then we've got the boomer generation says, hey, don't cut my weekends. You know, I like working Sundays. I like getting that double time. So that's something that I think everybody's facing.
I think you're right on that. Again, I had the pleasure to see your factories, and I was impressed on how digitized you are already, and the level of mastery of your data you have, and the utilization, which is not things you have done just because it's an actual buzzword. You have done all of that because it serves your Six Sigma policies and your quality standards and your efficiency goals. So how do you keep, with your leadership team, differentiating with all the things which are always in the discussion, yeah, buzzwords, and identifying exactly what is good for your company, what should be a priority, what should be on the next midterm, long-term plan as a priority to continue to evolve? Tell us a little bit about that process.
We have individuals who are always looking at the next big thing. There's a group of us that go to all of the technology shows and conferences and say what we can adapt, what makes sense for us. And, you know, some of it's throwing some darts at the dartboard and seeing which ones stick. The digitization, things like that, we will continue to evolve. We've seen the benefits from that, and everyone's in agreement. The robotics, we've seen the benefits from incorporating that and the automation. So all of management's on board with that. And then we have strategic meetings where we'll set aside, okay, here's what we're going to focus on this coming year. Here's what our budget's going to allow for based on the forecast. Mm-hmm. And then we list, here's the technologies and how we think they'll apply. And then we have tiger teams or the black sheep works that attack it. And most of the skill set we have in-house to cover it, between our advanced technology division, our continual improvement program. We have a very robust IT department, because we do program all of our own code for the machines, and our we design our own ERP system. And the data collection, the digitization, has evolved over the years. We first got involved with that with Six Sigma. We got into the control phase and needed SPC. And dot charts and people doing it by hand just wasn't cutting it. So yep. We decided we were going to go digital.
Yep.
and we design our own Orion Impact software that does statistical process control.
So that's your MES, mm-hmm. right?
We have what we call our Orion suite, which is the total MES.
Okay, I am.
And Impact is the SPC side. Mm-hmm. Horizon addresses real-time and historical capacity, efficiency, and planning and scheduling. Pulse is our in-house production control software. It knows where every serial number is at every moment and where it needs to go next. And then it sends alerts if it hasn't moved in the right amount of time. Updates says, hey, wait a minute. You've got a tub of parts with these six serial numbers in it that is sitting here and it's been here for 3 hours. Why hasn't it moved? We have our Eclipse software, which is root cause corrective action when a nonconformance is identified. The engineering and proper support and quality and supervisor get alerts to their phone through the software, not an email, that says, hey, you need to respond to here, and if not, punt it to somebody who can. And then it tracks the root cause and rates it, the corrective action.
Mm-hmm.
Now, everything we do, we try and collect data on.
Yeah, it's very impressive. You are really in a place where a lot of companies aiming to migrate to. But we know that this is not a journey which happens overnight. It's a fruit of many decades of work. And a journey, one day you embark on and you just keep working on it. It's not a start and a finish. Yeah. It's a journey.
It's an evolution.
Well, thank you so much on that. Talk a little bit about your company's approach about, I mean, your father built a company, you have make it evolve and developed it to what it is today. When you look into the future, and you have developed that global industrial champion with a presence on multiple continents, how do you ensure the long-term sustainability of the organization, making sure that the company will be prospering in the many years to come, while also looking at ESG, environmental, social, governance, and the entire discussion on sustainability of the planet, how to protect our, if no planet, no company. So we need both. What's the Maya tool approach on those important topics?
Okay, to start with on the longevity of it, you know, we continue to reinvest in the company. We never take anything out. Father, myself, no distributions. It all goes back to the people and to the equipment, facilities, capital expenditures. We're continuing to acquire and grow organically to fulfill our customers' needs for us to be an entire supply chain solution. Right now, we still outsource some work due to capacity issues, and we are adding equipment accordingly. Nice thing about building your own equipment is you do control your own capacity. And whereas someone else may have to wait 12 to 16 months for a new piece of equipment, a machine center, we can have it built in 12 to 16 weeks and on the floor. At one point, we were rolling off, and I think currently we're about doing the same, 4 machines a week off the line. Now, that's once the line is stocked. But once we had the line going and all the raw materials there that we needed, we can launch 4 machines each week. We've just expanded up in our main facility. We doubled the size. We're looking at some other potentials in Europe. There's a excellent opportunity for growth in the European market. You know, we're not content to stay where we are. We want to dominate the supply chain. We want to be the solution for hot section components. Our competition really, you know, there's maybe two other smaller players that do similar work where they're vertically integrated and able to manage a portion of the supply chain. We have a bigger portion of it, and we'll continue to grow the capacity in all those, like the coating, the EB welding, things like that that, you know, right now we're small in, but we'll continue to grow and develop it. We have space in our Greenville facility to expand. We had recently expanded in Kentucky with a new facility, and we'll continue to make the equipment. We keep hiring electrical engineers and assembly technicians so mm-hmm. that we can build equipment faster.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
and more efficiently. We have long-term contracts with our customer. We try to be a partner, not someone that you offload your overflow work to. So we've got 10-year contracts, and we like to work in the realm of 7 to 10 years. We try and give the customers reasons not to look anywhere else and not to get in. You know, they don't need to get into it. That's our biggest competition, is our customers, because the General Electrics and Pratt Whitney's do have very capable shops of their own. So we would like them not to have to add any more equipment to their shops and utilize us. And they know that. We've made that commitment, and they know that we're in it for the long haul. We always tell them we're not for sale. We have no interest in going to private equity or anything else. I think we've got a successful business model, and we're able to support it.
Excellent. Talk a little bit about more on the side of corporate social responsibility. So you mentioned already about all you do for your employees, and that's really remarkable. I think best in class. How is Meyer Tool involved in the greater community or in the communities of where you have your locations? Talk a little bit about that dimension.
Well, we work with all the local universities and trade schools to do internships, and we also send people in for apprenticeship programs, things like that. We give scholarships. Now, that's more from the family than from the business, but we support the local universities. We do community service projects. We do organized walks, give to the United Way and other companies, other groups that are doing community service. We've had programs where they'll work to go out and do neighborhood beautification projects, things like that. And then recycling. You had mentioned earlier about what we're doing for the planet. Mm-hmm. We have a big push on recycling and zero waste, and to eliminate anything that's going down the drain except for water. We don't have things that produce emissions, so we really don't have an issue there. The chemical stripping, we make sure we do handle that. We reclaim the acids and the metals that are in it and then recycle as best possible. Be responsible. It doesn't go down the drain, doesn't go out the door without going in the proper storage into the proper facilities.
Excellent. Thank you so much. I will start to wrap up a little bit, and I have a few last questions. So this podcast is really about the industrialists, and we are, again, so proud to have you as the first industrialist speaking on that podcast and on episode one. So if you would have advice for people engaging on that career path, being an industrialist, being an entrepreneur in the industrial sector, what kind of advice would you give people? A few things would come to mind. Of course, they will have to know a lot of things, but a few key advices for them.
Make sure you're up to date on the latest technology. Read the periodicals, read the internet, go to the conferences. Stay ahead of the competition, or at least keep up with it. Don't let them get in front of you, because it's going to be heck to catch up. You know, it's much easier to kind of be part of the initial group stumbling through it as opposed to catching up later. We try and make sure that we know everything that's going on with 3D printing, because we're into 3D printing now, blue light scanning, robotics, AI. We have a PhD who's in AI on our workforce, and he updates management regularly to make sure that we know the latest and greatest and how we can take advantage of it. And I would say to anybody who's an industrialist, make sure that you know what the trends are and where it's going. That's a big one. And double down on technology, even when the times get tight. That's one thing we've done, is even when, you know, like during COVID, we did not stop the R&D work. We did not stop investing in the technology. We kept that going, knowing that in the long run, it would pay off. So it's painful. I mean, you know, because everybody wants to see that big number at the end of the month and end of the quarter, but some months aren't going to be as good as others, just based on the industry and based on the marketplace. So keep investing.
Yeah, I think this is absolutely critical. especially in this day and age where technology evolves so fast. We are really in an acceleration cycle of technology and development. That's why it's called a revolution, fourth industrial revolution.
Yes.
Nothing is the same after as it was before.
No, and it's changing at an exponential curve now. It's not a linear change in terms of the technology and the incorporation. It's exponential.
So another dimension of being an entrepreneur, industrialist, and certainly we can only imagine how busy you are in your role. But I also know you have a beautiful family and you have many passions. So how do you as a person keep your work-life balance? And tell us a little bit about what you like to do besides work and developing the company and the technologies.
Well, I'm lucky because I am passionate about my work. I love what we do. I love aerospace. I love data. So I'm very fortunate that, coming to work is part of my joy in life. But I do have a big family. I've got triplet 19-year-old daughters in college, and then a 12-year-old daughter, and my wife, and then my father. So the way I balance it, because we do work a lot of hours and some strange hours. Got night shift you got to take care of. You've got weekends, things like that. I learned a couple years ago, you have to set aside and schedule me time. And I try to do that. I try to schedule, and it varies. It's not every day at 7 o'clock. It's bow time. I say, I'm going to put it in the schedule that I get an hour to just do self-care, whatever it is that I'm going to do that helps Bo relax and get focused for the next day. And my main hobby is music. I'm a guitarist, drummer, DJ, and bass and keyboardist. So I like to record, create new material and record it on the laptop. And I don't publish it. It's just for me and my family and friends. We listen to it. But it helps me be focused the next day, because it kind of pulls you out of it and lets you kind of reset the whole cognitive capability. But I learned that making sure I had that hour was very important. And then I also try and make sure that we get at least one meal as a family together, all of us, whether it be lunch, dinner, breakfast. Try and, grab a half hour there where everyone's in the same room and gets to catch up. And that seems to be working pretty well.
Well, Bo, I would probably still have 3 million questions, but I think it's a time for everything. I want to thank you for that very open conversation and for sharing your experience and the remarkable journey of your company. Again, very impressed with the company you have built, with the technologies you are transforming and the materials you are transforming, the applications of your products, but also the level of maturity of automation, digitalization, lean management, Six Sigma, all the things you have been talking about. So again, it's a treat for us to have you on that podcast. Thank you again very much. And I will hand over to Anne for some closing remarks.
Thank you all again for having me. This has been a joy. I love talking about this stuff. And I look forward to further conversations with both of you.
We do too.
Well, what an incredible journey we've had today on the Industrialist Podcast with Bo Easton, delving into the heart of Meyer Tool and the inspiring story behind its success. I want to extend a heartfelt thank you to our distinguished guest, Bo. Bo, your insights, experiences, and the genuine way of you shared your journey are invaluable. It's been a true pleasure and a great inspiration having you on the Industrialist Podcast. Now to our listeners, thank you for joining us on this exploration into the world of manufacturing excellence. If you enjoyed today's episode, be sure to subscribe, rate, and leave a review. Your feedback means the world to us. Remember, this is just one chapter in our ongoing series of conversations with industrial leaders. Stay tuned for additional riveting stories, insights, and strategies on the Industrialist Podcast. I'm Anne Kappel, and on behalf of Yannick Schilly and the entire team at Altix Consulting, thank you for being a part of our community. Until next time, keep innovating, keep leading, and keep making an impact in the industrial world.